1850 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. It's all about self-published books today. Fantastic array. Let's begin and get into it. Gary J. Burns. Gary, tell us what your book is about. It's called To Eat the World.
Hi, Joe. Yes, thanks for having me on. It's about a Nazi plot to take over the world economy, would you believe?
Mm-hmm.
And it's left up to a chef and an art dealer then to save us all. It's based on reality. In that at the end of World War II, the Americans took all the top Nazi rocket scientists across the Atlantic, which is why they've had military dominance for the last half century. And my story then is about one of the Nazis bringing a lot of stolen art from Europe, again, very topical, and cornering the New York art market. So I've gone ahead and published it. I've published a few books myself now over the last few years, and I'm very excited about this one.
You say on your back, emboldened by the rise of right-wingers and the broken economy, the Nazis plan to take over the US presidency, destroy Wall Street, enslave the world, launching their coup at a King Louis the 16th themed banquet. It sounds like a hacked Sony email at this stage. It's a fantastic plan. Where did you get the idea from?
The idea, well, I'm very much interested in history, Joe, and I also love a bit of art and some fine food. So instead of having like a mainstream thriller, I thought I'd make one where, yes, there was a big plot, but it was left up to normal people to save the world as opposed to some, you know, private eye kind of character or a super cop.
So how do you go about self-publishing?
Self-publishing, now, there are two ways to do it, Joe. You can do print on demand, which means you design the cover, you design the page layout and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Then you use a company called CreateSpace, which is owned by Amazon. And then you upload the files, and then when somebody wants to buy your book through Amazon, they order it into CreateSpace, then one copy of your book is printed and mailed to the person who ordered it.
So how much does that cost you, Gary?
Yeah, I would end up, it cost me nothing to set it up, Joe, and this is very, very important, nothing to set it up. You just supply the material. And then you would make a margin, depending, again, on the price, the retail price you put on it. I could make a couple of euro off each one. But then the more, I'm also selling my print books in Hannah's Bookshop here in Rathmines, my local bookstore, Dublin's best indie store. So if somebody wants to get it without wanting to go online, they can pick it up here. But the more exciting thing now that's happening in self-publishing, Joe, is the whole world of e-books, where it's quite straightforward now for anybody at no cost to distribute their ebooks themselves into Apple iTunes, onto Amazon again for the Kindle, Barnes & Noble, even the US library purchasing system. And there's a company called Smashwords, which I use, which is the world's best indie ebook publisher. And I'd recommend anyone who's interested in self-publishing to have a look at smashwords.com.
A sexy, thrilling tale of great food, classic art, and the meaning of beauty, love, and life.
Yes.
It's like an edition of a Rachel Allen cookery programme. But it looks fantastic.
Well,
it's got
Thank you, Joe.
It would jump out because it has a mix of the swastika and the stars and stripes on the cover. And we will give all the details on our website, and we'll try and tweet as many details. Well done. And it looks, it sits comfortably beside any book on any bookshelf in any bookshop. It looks really well. That's let me go now to Jerry Hickey. Jerry, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
What's
How
the
are
plot
you?
In the ruins of Germany after World War II? Off you go.
Well, here we are. It's not quite like Gary's book. Well, possibly a little bit more down to earth, but it's really a book about Edith Stein, who is
a Jewish philosopher
and later a nun, and actually now a saint of the Catholic Church, who was missing after World War II. And this is a kind of a told as a thriller or a story with a young journalist as a protagonist who is asked to look for her, and the reader learns a little bit more about Edith Stein through the search by the protagonist in this book, a journalist named Karen Bauer. So the idea really was, Joe, was to get people, young people particularly, to read about an historical or even a religious figure that they might normally go to. I had my own daughter Claire in mind when I started this book, and I published it for that reason. I wanted somebody who mightn't be interested in history to have a look at a historical figure and uh, in a in an interesting way.
It's a brilliant way of doing it. Again, it stands the book. The production is beautiful. Your daughter read it, but she felt it wasn't really her sort of book. Well done, given that you wrote it for her. I presume she's a teenager.
Well, yeah, she wasn't. Well, she wasn't unenthusiastic, but I wouldn't say it bowled her over. And then actually, in fact, what happened? A lot of people who read it in the older generation, let's say 65 and upwards, seemed to like it a lot, and the younger people were slightly more neutral about it. That seems to be the reaction I got to it. You know,
and it gets for you. You got another knockback, but it doesn't bother you. A friend of mine gave a gift of the book to Daniel Day-Lewis for his wife Rebecca Miller, the well-known writer. What happened, Jerry?
That's right. A friend of mine, John McHugo, is a very good friend of Daniel Day-Lewis, and they had lunch in Animo a few months ago, and John bought the book from me and gave it to Daniel Day-Lewis. So he said, here's a book, your wife might be very interested in this, because Rebecca Miller's mother was German and also Jewish, in fact. So he gave it to her, but Daniel Day-Lewis looked at it and said, oh no, he said, not another book. We get 200 of these a month. So if I was expecting to sell the film rights for it, it didn't work out that way.
And what do you do in real life, Jerry?
Well, I'm actually a retired civil servant. I'm a former official of the Department of Justice, and I do a little bit of legal consultancy on the side. But I've always done a little bit of writing over the years. I had a play on the radio, RTE radio, many years ago, and a bit of that. But this is the first novel I've ever tried, a historical novel. So I'll have a go at another one now.
And your recommended retail price is €5.50, which is more than worth it. As I say, these are not stapled A4 pages. These are full Monty productions, and they're getting better and better. Well done, Jerry Hickey. It's called A Little Red House. It's a fantastic way to read about and find out more about Edith Stein and her incredible life as a philosopher, teacher, lecturer, and indeed convert. Now, Karen Bauer is the name of the lead character, so to speak, in Jerry Hickey's book. But we now have Karen Power on the line. Karen, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Your book is called.
Thanks a million for having me.
Good, but your book is called, and tell me what it's about.
My book is called Butterfly Barn, and it's about three women who discovered they shared the same dream. So the book is about love and life and loss and the ability of the human spirit to endure. That would be kind of, I suppose, my take on Butterfly
Barn. But you see, I can sell this better than you. Just read the back cover. Grace Fitzgerald hopes to sign a contract with an American crew. Keep going. Have you got it there in front of you?
Read
the back cover.
Grace Fitzgerald hopes to sign a contract with an American cruise corporation to bring cruise liners into the idyllic coastal town of Bayrush in Ireland.
Okay.
Her fiancé, Dirk, doesn't seem to grasp just how important it is to her. On her way to Dublin Airport, Grace catches a glimpse of Jack Leslie, her first love.
Wow.
And then the story goes off with them.
He's married now. You've left out the best line. He's married now, but he still has the power to turn her knees to jelly. Grace is about to make the biggest decision of her life. Will it be the right one? That will get people reading this.
I'm hoping that, and it's happening, Joe, here in Waterford. I launched it in the book centre here in Waterford, and over 300 copies sold on the night.
Well done.
I'm just stunned by the whole thing, to be honest.
It's set between Ireland and New York. You went on a writer's weekend. Would you recommend?
I think that to write is just one of life's great gifts, I think. And I think we all have a chance to do it. So I did. I went on a writer's workshop. And from that, then, I started to follow the dream, you know. The Arts Council here in Waterford have been fantastic.
Brilliant.
Support as well to me. And Margaret Organ of the Arts Council. The Library Service have taken on the book in four counties. And all of this has happened since the 14th
of November. And Karen, has anyone, just for our listeners, anyone said to you, your book reminded me of, or you're very like, or who what genre is it? Is it Cecilia? Is it Marion Keyes?
Well,
is it Maeve Binchy?
You know what, actually, a lady from one of the most prestigious
publishing houses,
bookshops in the country, Hodges and Figgis, said it reminded her of Maeve Binchy with seasoning. And
lovely.
I just thought, oh my God,
lovely,
when I heard that.
That's what you want.
So they're stocking the book, Waterstones in Cork, and it's now being stocked in many, many bookshops across the country. So I'm still, as I say, breathless about the whole thing, you know.
And it's a beautiful cover. It's called Butterfly Barn, self-published by Karen Power. Well done, Karen. Let me go to James Lawless. This is called Peeling Oranges. A book, and you got an endorsement on the cover from no less than Gabriel Byrne, a book to lose oneself in. I highly recommend it. What's it about, James?
Well, it's about a paternal quest, Joe, about this young man who discovers when his father dies in 1950 that he was impotent. His father was a diplomat in Franco Spain. And the young guy, Derek, goes through his diaries and discovers this about him. And his mother is sort of ailing. She's getting early dementia, and she doesn't want to tell him anything about her past. And so this sets Derek on a quest, which takes him to Spain and ultimately to the north of Ireland, where he tries to find out who his birth father really is, with tragic consequences. It takes in a lot of the history of the Spanish Civil War and the Irish Civil War. And I had to do a fair bit of research, in the National Archives, which is ironic because I come from the Liberties myself, and my grandmother had a shop where the archives are now in Bishop Street.
Oh, fantastic.
So I wound up back in the same spot, same location.
And what an Aladdin's cave that is in there.
Cave, indeed, yes.
And Katrina Crowe and everyone, and the most helpful people in the country, I think, are in the National Archives. And it begins in reception with the man on reception. They're very, very helpful. It's called Peeling Oranges. And you lectured in Spanish in All Hallows.
I did for a while, Joe. There were priests who were setting off for Mexico on missions. And I was asked, would I go in there and do a few hours with them to try and give them the basics of Spanish before they set out.
How long did it take you to write the book?
Well, the book started out, would you believe, originally as a short story called Diaries. And I got interested in the research of this character in Spain because I study Spanish myself. And when I got into the archives, then the short story started developing. And would you believe it was about 5 or 6 years the book took to actually write? And it was
I do believe it because it's a fantastic effort, and it's more than an effort. It's a fantastic achievement. Full stop. It's a fantastic achievement. Again, it looks and stands and sits like any other novel. And by the way, the four novels we've already mentioned, Peeling Oranges, that's James at the moment, Jerry Hickey, The Little Red House, Edith Stein is the character there, Karen Power, and Gary J. Bourne's To Eat the World, That American Stroke Nazi Plot. They're all based on a lot of research. That's on their own, James. It's on your own interest in Spain and the Civil War and and melding that in, and the same with the other books as well. So well done, just James Lawless. And are you retired as well, James, or are you a full-time writer?
I'm retired and I'm writing full-time.
Okay, well done. Well done.
Thanks very much.
Well done. Let's go to two colour books now, so to speak. Tom Freeney. Tom, good afternoon, Tom.
Hello, how are you, Joe? How are you doing?
Good. Tell us, let me grab the book, because it's a fantastic achievement. It really is. Congratulations.
Thanks very much. Yeah.
Everybody on the island of Ireland has seen your artwork because you are the man and indeed the company that paint the buses, especially the one-off, the Coca-Cola bus, the Evening Herald bus, the Dublin bus tour bus, the Bulmers bus, the gimmicky. How did you get into it?
Well, I'm a sixth-generation sign writer. So we were a two-man team, myself and my father, in 1987, working from home, and we were asked to go out and paint a bus in the millennium, to celebrate the millennium, Dublin's millennium, in 1987. And we're still painting buses to this day.
And people will remember the millennium bus. It was a double-decker bus, but it had all the scenes from Dublin, the Halfpenny Bridge, the horse and carriage, Dublin Castle. Absolutely. All done by hand, Tom.
All done by hand in those days, yeah.
It's fantastic.
Freeney's graphics, but of course we had to adopt the modern technology, and we're printing and spray booth and so on. Now we're painting close to 200 buses a year now. But back then, everything was by hand, yeah.
People then
didn't believe us, never mind now.
Yeah. And what was the hardest one to do?
Well, I suppose you'd say there was a bus for the First National, which was nearly like a forgery job because you were copying paintings from the National Gallery.
There's
a very photographic face on the side of a Johnson & Johnson bus advertising cosmetics. which was a difficult jam because it had to be picture perfect.
That was the Pink Lady. I have it Pink Lady, in front of me, so to speak.
Yeah.
But what prompted you to produce this magnificent book? It is unbelievable, the quality of it. There's about many colour illustrations are in this. Have you counted them?
I don't know, there's 256 pages.
Wow, and there's a colour illustration on every single page. You get the background, you get the story. For aficionados, it even gives you the reg number of the bus, it gives you the fleet number, it gives the time it was on. Like, for example, the Pink Lady, which is the fantastic image on the side. It was for Johnson & Johnson Baby Lotion, and that was... went from July 89 to October 1990. Fantastic.
Yeah, some of them didn't last so long, but they were all hand-painted then. But what prompted the book, I suppose, well, when we first started painting buses, we went in, as myself and my dad, Ned Freeney, painting buses. And we weren't very good at taking photographs of our work, but there was bus enthusiasts that would follow us around, like the paparazzi, taking photographs. And every time we looked around, it was somebody taking a photograph. So it got to the stage where, well, if they're taking photographs, we should be taking photographs. So I had a mad collection of photographs stuffed in a box up in the attic. Nobody ever sees them. And I said, I really should do something with them. And
well, you've done something magnificent. How do people...
the bus enthusiasts, and between us, we cobbled together this book,
But how do people get this book?
Well, at the moment, it's on www.theartofpaintingbuses.com.
And how much would you pay for it?
€25 plus postage, €29 delivered.
It is worth much more than that.
It is.
And
it
I suspect it costs much more than that, did it?
It did, but for me, it's about recording the work as works of art, because they really were works of art back then.
And they're part of our social history. They really are. People will recognise them. You go back to older buses in Bus Air and Donegal, and then all the new buses, the expressway buses, look absolutely stunning because
the expressway bus is particularly nice, I think. Yeah,
you did that. Your firm did that as well.
Well,
congratulations, Tom. It is a magnificent. Are you still sign writing?
Oh yeah. Well, we're not sign writing because things have moved on, but we're a sign company, very active sign company.
Freeney's,
12 up here in Tala, and.
Well, I think there's going to be any aficionado, anyone even from Dublin, anyone who's into transport history, anyone that's into art, because these are works of art.
The reaction has been overwhelming.
Well done.
It's nice that people are interested.
I remember the Smarty Bus. You remember the Smarty Bus? Fantastic.
Everybody still talks about the Smarty Bus.
Well done. Yeah. That's Tom Freeney. It's called The Art of Painting Buses, and I cannot recommend it enough in terms of what a beautiful, really fantastically well produced book. They call it a coffee table book, but this is a social history. Now let me go to an odd sounding title, isn't it, Colm Meighan? Off you go, Colm. Sell this book.
How you doing, Joe? How are you? And your listeners, hello. My name is Colm Meighan. I'm the Air Medical Officer for the National Ambulance Service. And we did a book, my colleague and I, Martin Byrne, we're both serving members of the National Ambulance Service, and it's a pictorial history of ambulance vehicles in Ireland.
Okay.
And it goes back to 1895, to the very first horse-drawn ambulance that was actually ever designed and built in Dublin, and that was by the Dublin Fire Brigade. And they have a replica of that now. And we progressed through that, through the rising First and Second World Wars, the 1960s, pictures of our vehicles since then, and including a sleigh ambulance that we actually have in one of the health authorities for towing a patient literally through the snow by two ambulance drivers, as they were then termed. And it goes right up to 2014 with the more modern ambulances and motorbikes and our emergency air medical service that we have in Athlone, which I'm associated with.
And you even have the 1913 Dublin Corporation Ambulance, the first ambulance to arrive in Dublin City. So that would have been active during the Rising.
That is correct. And would you believe, though, before that, the Pembroke Fire and Ambulance Service in Balls Bridge were the first fire and ambulance service to receive motorised ambulances in the very early 1900s. And actually, the Dublin Fire Brigade operated and the John's Ambulance operated during the 1916 Rising. And they were exceptionally busy, and they operated both motorised and horse-drawn ambulances through that fairly troubled time.
And when you were looking, when you found this photograph of, say, the 1916 ambulance, was there any documentation? Because I'm on the search for the family of a young boy called Eugene Lynch from Golden Bridge, who's buried in Golden Bridge Cemetery. I found his death cert the other day. He was 8 years and 6 months. He was shot dead, we believe, outside his house on Easter week on the Friday. But I cannot find any other information. So, and well, I know I've looked up the ambulance log, you know, the one that went on sale there from a few weeks ago, the Dublin City Library bought it. And a lot, because they were so busy, as you know, a lot of the calls they just never got to. But there's no record of this call. So,
well, I could probably point you in the direction of the Dublin Fire Brigade Museum in Marino, who gave me great assistance in this book. They have some documentation. In fact, in the book, my own book here now with Martin, we have a documentation of an incident where the ambulance horse was actually shot during admission. Wow. And obviously rendered the ambulance unserviceable. But, I would like to say we had terrific assistance from the Fire Service, the National Ambulance Service, Northern Ireland Ambulance Service in the production of this book. And for anyone that's interested in transport or vehicles, you will actually see, you know, as I said, how they evolved from the horse-drawn to the motorised, now air ambulance.
It's a stunning labour of love. It really is. It's circa, one photograph, flipped open a page, 1954, a Rolls-Royce ambulance, absolutely beautiful, belonging to the Belvedere Ambulance Service in Dublin. Picture
that's
a Dublin
correct.
Airport, obviously collecting a patient or whatever. You've gathered together an incredible collection.
Thanks very much, Joe. We actually had some very unusual private ambulances. Years ago, they used to have Volkswagen camper vans as ambulances in the old Gleeson ambulance in Stillorgan. And, you know, obviously we've evolved, but we're still driving forms of Volkswagen and Mercedes ambulances at this point in time. You probably noticed we also have our motorcycle response unit there.
Yeah,
who are now currently driving very powerful bikes in their rapid
And how do people, it's self-published, how do people get their hands on this? Again,
if you want a copy
book.
Of this, we have an email address, and it's a very simple one. It's ambulancebook@gmail.com. And they basically people can access the book through that. And it's a great novelty book for people interested in transport and the evolution of ambulance vehicles in Ireland.
And the only one I ever saw like this was Carl Martin's wonderful book on the history and the photographic history, indeed, of Irish Army vehicles. But this is a fantastic piece and a fantastic piece.
Thank you for that, John. I've taken some inspiration from Carl himself now, having read his books. Both my colleague and I decided we'd do something for the job because we've been in the job now 20 years and there's no real pictorial record of vehicles, of ambulance vehicles. So as you can see from the internal shots, how they've evolved from basically a stretcher and a blanket to a very modern high-tech type vehicle.
Well done, well done. That's Colin Thank Meegan, you, and the book is called Ambulance Vehicles of Ireland. And again, I cannot, it's a pictorial history. Barry Taylor before the break. Barry, good afternoon.
Hello, hi Joe.
This is another self-published book, brilliant production. Looks, it's not too much smaller than a telephone directory. It's such an incredible effort. What's it called and what's it about?
It's called Music and a Breeze of Wind, Traditional Dance Music in West Clare, 1870 to 1970. Fairly self-explanatory, I think, the title. It's about dance music in West Clare, the history of it and the development of it, and particularly the people who played it.
And it has never been done before?
No.
Isn't that incredible?
I don't think, I think there's a kind of paucity of studies, of kind of micro-studies of individual areas and the musicians and the tradition of playing.
And why is West Clare, we know how important it is and the heritage, past and indeed the music present. Why does West Clare generate so much incredible traditional dance music?
Well, I think it did, you know, talking about the period that I cover. One of the reasons, obviously, is that West Clare is a very isolated area.
Mm-hmm.
To an extent, you could say the same about Connemara or Donegal or Kerry. You know, the isolated coast areas. Their traditions just lived longer because they were further away from, I suppose, the urban development, etc.
And they made their own entertainment. But this book, how long did it take you to write this book?
I was listening to your other interviewees and the time it took. Came over to the Willie Clancy School first in 1975 and I started recording people in West Clare, then talking about the music. And writing about it, and, you know, this is really kind of the end result of all those years of kind of work. Actually sitting down and writing and putting the book together took me, I guess, about 3 years.
I've tweeted a photograph there, the cover, it's 350 pages, and it's a fun. How do people get their hands on it?
The easiest way is through myself. There are a couple of shops in Ennis who sell it, but mainly I distribute it myself. You can email me at MIBW, which is basically Music and a Breeze of Wind, at aircom.net.
Okay,
and most of the copies are...
It's a fantastic achievement, Barry. And again, I say to everybody listening, we will put up a PDF on our website of all the titles, and then you just simply either go to Amazon or Google them, because even we started doing this, I think, about 7 years ago, and at that stage we were trying to give out addresses and it became very cumbersome. But now we just, once you get the name of the book, Google it and you will get the information. Thanks indeed, Barry Taylor, 51551.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
David Snow, it sounds like a book. Tell us a book written after listening to Liveline. Tell us about it.
Good afternoon, Joe. Thanks for the opportunity once again to be on your show. Universal Scams and Fraud Detection. It's 18 chapters broken into two parts. Mm-hmm. First 9 chapters is on fraud management, how to prevent fraud. If you're in business, it might be of interest to you. It covers everything from why criminals commit fraud to cross-border investigations, interview techniques. The second 9 chapters, Universal Fraud and Scams, is very much written and designed for ordinary individuals who are caught up in unfortunate scams, a little bit like that poor unfortunate lady who featured on your show, Kathleen Byrne. It covers things like how to prevent fraud against the elderly, insurance fraud, identity theft, car scams, internet dating scams. So it's written in two parts, and hopefully people will buy it and enjoy it. And it's available at davidsnow.ie.
And you've published before, you told...
Yes, indeed, Joe. Yes, I was on this show actually December 2012, and following talking to Joe, I ended up picking up a couple of awards in Europe and North America, and featured ultimately on the Late Late Show back in May 2013. And that all came from talking to yourself, and if I might say a big hello as well to Sue Leonard of the Irish Examiner, who did a very nice feature on my book.
Well, because it's a fantastic area, Now, tell us straight, David, you can. It's coming up to Christmas, be totally honest. Who is hacking Sony?
If I knew that question, Joe, Banksy, I probably wouldn't be talking to you.
you have a chapter called Banks, Credit Cards and Cybercrime.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating. Who was it that said, was it Russ Limbaugh, one of the so-called right-wing Americans said, America has lost their first cyber war.
Yeah. Cybercrime, it's the crime of the future, Joe. It's something that... You know, we look at other areas like identity theft, we look at Facebook, we look at LinkedIn, all fantastic tools. But the amount of personal information that we are putting up into cyberspace is quite frightening. And it's open to individuals, criminal fraternity. If you don't have proper security or virus protection on your computer, that you will be hacked. And if you are hacked, you could be a victim of a crime. So be very, very careful with the information that you're putting up there. To answer your question, Joe, I don't know who was hacking into Sony. I initially thought it might be a publicity stunt, but I don't think so at this stage. And if I knew that question, I'd be probably quite a wealthy man.
Okay, well, it's a brilliant idea. It's called Universal Scams and Fraud Detection. It's not a novel. This is a handy self-help book, especially if we're running a company, and it's written by David Snow. And again, comes highly recommended. And people, again, Google and they'll get David up on their screen. The artist, thanks, David. The artist on the island. Good afternoon to Pete Hogan.
Hello there, Joe. And hello to all your listeners.
Describe your book in 12 words.
In 12 words? Oh, impossible. But it's about the artist on the island. I've always been fascinated by islands. And when I had an opportunity to spend a winter on Achelbeg Island, mm-hmm. in County Mayo, I went for it big time. And I kept a journal, and the resulting illustrated book is the product of that winter, grim winter on Achelbeg Island.
Was it all you expected? I don't think it was.
Well, I was very ambitious and uncompromising in those days, and I saw myself as sort of a Paul Gauguin, or Paul Henry, I suppose, to put it in an Irish context. Paul Henry was fascinated by Achill, And to an extent, so was I.
So, like Paul Gauguin, you wanted to be famous, aloof, celebrated, and revered.
Yes,
from an island.
And it didn't really happen, I'm afraid.
And you tell the story of two farmers who were swept to their death.
Well, that was a very tragic incident that happened while I was there, and it sort of brought home to me the seriousness of living on the West Coast in a place like Achill.
They were looking after their sheep and a wind took them.
Yes, yeah.
Incredible. You have it illustrated in the form of a diary, beautiful illustration. Again, beautifully, who printed and published and how did you get it looking so well?
Well, I needed help with that side of things, and I'm not great on computers and so forth. I do the illustrations, and then I got help from a very nice guy, David Gibbons, who has a small imprint called Liffey Press. And this is the second book I've done with him, and the first one was was almost a bestseller, The Log of the Molly Bee. But this one, I'm afraid, has fallen under the radar for various reasons, and I'm sort of flogging it around.
Yeah, well, it shouldn't, because it's a lovely book that will sit, and you can pick it up, and you can go through particular times.
The idea is a nice object, rather than it isn't available as a download.
And this, because it's beautiful colour illustrations.
Something to keep it, make a beautiful present.
All written by you, obviously, but illustrated by you as well. And the monastic life, it's not for you, I suspect, after the experience.
Well, I went to a monastic school, Roscoe, and I've always thought that maybe that is a bit... And I am a bit of a loner, and this was certainly... but this was a bit one step too far, becoming Robinson Crusoe...
But everybody, at some stage of their life, Pete, fantasizes about packing it all in to live in isolation.
I think they do, yes. It is a universal fascination.
Yeah, I think they should read your book first.
Very good. Well, thank you, Joe.
Yeah,
it's available, hopefully, in bookshops. The distribution thing is quite difficult to, as you know.
Yeah,
I've been bringing it around to marine bookshops myself. There's one out in Dunleary and there's one in Sutton. They have it, or it's available from me at phogan.com.
Okay, and we'll put all that information up. It's, a fantastic story, a real-life story of Pete Hogan, who took to Achill Beg, and you've lovely illustrations, lovely maps in it, and what happened that winter. Thanks indeed, Pete. Let me go to Willie Fow Abbott, or Willie Abbott, I suppose, is what people call you. It's called The Mystery of the Nyemba Ambush. Tell people about it, Willie.
Hello, Joe. Thanks for having me on, Joe.
You're welcome. Off you go.
Yeah, Joe, it's the story of the Nyemba ambush when the 10 Irish troops got butchered that time by the Balubas.
In the Congo.
In the Congo, yes. I met a lot of them there when I was in the Irish Fusiliers in the Fogs. That's why on the front you see Willie Fog Abbott. I was in the Fogs and we met them at Wheeler's Air Base on the way out.
And is your book, you say The Mystery of the Nyemba Ambush, but is it, do you solve the mystery?
There's a lot in it. There were supposed to be two survivors, but in actual fact there was three, according to my book. So it's three survivors.
Yeah, but you say on the back, do not begin to read this novel at night. You'll be up all morning. But
that's right.
Is that because it's a, I can't put it down, or it's a frightening?
You won't be able to put it down. And there are the two recognised survivors. That's Joe Fitzpatrick, who lives in Cabra at the moment.
Hello, Joe, yeah.
And then another chap out, and I think he's in Ballyferm at... Kenny, I think his name is.
Yeah, you call him Kenny 57, which what
that's
his name.
Correct, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I've been out talking to Joe myself. And I'm in the book telling the story, basically, of the United Nations and how they've let people down over the years, Joe, you see.
Okay.
From the top echelons right down to the top people in the Irish Army to, and I make no apologies for it, castigating these people. And the top people in the United Nations for the way these people were treated.
Yeah.
The people in Nyemba were thrown to the wolves.
My God. Same
as the people at Jadotville.
Another,
you know?
Of which there's a few books as well.
Yes, yeah. There's a few books out. And, I mean, the people were sent out and they didn't have any proper orders. they...
Should you were in Boldswold uniforms for tropical...
Well, that's another... They were in the Boldswold uniforms.
Tropical weather.
Up to their
my
neck.
God.
They were in... They had the leather gaiters and peaked caps. And, Joe, I was at Wheels Air Base, and I saw those men, and it was pitiful looking at them. They actually fell off the Globemaster onto the tarmac, most of them.
When they landed, because such was the...
And we brought them into the mess and gave them lagers or whatever we could give them and help them. And as I said, I laid the blame down at Conor Cruise O'Brien's feet and Keogh's, the whole lot of those top people.
Okay.
They said, and Conor Cruise O'Brien in his book says, the Irish soldiers died because they didn't have elaborate political briefing. Now imagine coming out and saying a thing like that. The men didn't need elaborate political briefing. All the Irish soldiers for the United Nations, all they wanted was sand boots, tropical gear, yeah, proper weapons, that sort of stuff.
On vehicles.
You know?
It's called the mystery of the Nyamba ambush.
And they needed specific orders, which they didn't get.
Okay, and how can you get this book?
Well, Joe, I have it available at my own address, which is 71 Coltry Avenue, Ballymun.
Dublin 9, okay.
And it's also in Hannah's bookshop of in Rathmines.
Well done.
If I could just finish, Joe.
Yeah, really briefly, yeah.
I'm quoting you from Common and Quinlan. That's the book is mainly to show how the United Nations troops, not necessarily Irish troops, all the United Nations troops have been treated with callousness and disrespect.
Okay.
Common and Quinlan himself said the people of Ireland will have to pass judgment on those responsible for the callous disregard for 156 Irish soldiers.
Okay.
And he also said the United Nations made a complete mess of things, organised by the Belgian government. We were lured into Jadotville, he said, and we ended up as hostages.
Okay.
And that also applied to the Nyamba ambush, Joe.
Okay, it's called The Mystery of the Nyamba Ambush. Thanks indeed, Willie Abbott. A Stony Road, in many ways, Willie just described it. Patrick J. Kyle, what's your book? Patrick J., what's your... It's an autobiography.
Yes.
And give me the blurb that you would put on the back to try and sell this book.
Yeah. Good afternoon, Joe, and thanks for having me on. On the back you'll see it's an autobiography that will echo in a million hearts as you laugh and cry with Patrick Coyle on his tragic comic childhood journey through the 30s and 40s rural Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
Follow him as a young teenage emigrant to the heart of industrial England and the colourful checkered career that follows. The narrative is always lively and entertaining, made up as it is of 50 individual stories.
You say
each one complete in itself.
And was life, or has life so far been a stony road for you, Patrick?
Yeah, I suppose it is an apt metaphor. But of course, we could probably say that most people's lives are stony in many respects. So I would regard it as a metaphor for what follows.
How long did it take you to write it? I know it's your life, says you, but how long did it take you?
Well, it wasn't a very serious endeavour, really. It started off quite harmlessly with just some tape recordings, and then I thought I might put the whole lot together as a book. But originally it was never meant to see the light of day. The main impulse was... It came from a feeling, the need to create a record
and it's
for our children and our grandchildren of what childhood was like 70 years ago.
It's beautiful. And you've lovely illustrations in it. You've collected photographs. I know you're from Monaghan, the great literary tradition of Monaghan, Patrick Kavanagh to Patrick McCabe. Incredible literary tradition. It's called A Stony Road, Patrick J. Kyle. Again, J. Kyle, self-published by choicepublishing.ie, and that's where you'll find it. Thanks indeed, Patrick. Where's Gerald? Is Gerald Rice there? Gerald, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. Thank you for having me on the programme.
Yeah, thank you for contacting us. Gayborn's autobiography was called The Time of My Life. Yours called The Time of Our Lives.
That's right. It's a little bit later than Patrick's there because I was born in 1943.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not an autobiography in my case, although it is illustrated by examples that happened to me. But they were the kind of things that happened to thousands and thousands of children growing up in the 40s, 50s and early 60s. It starts in County Down when I was born, and it goes on to Birmingham, where I was largely brought up, although every summer holidays, for the long school holidays, I was back in County Down at my grandparents' farm, And my other grandparents, my father's father, had a workshop and garage. It was very different from life today. We didn't have mobile phones or anything like that. The country life in County Down was very similar to the country life at any part of Ireland at the time. It was a small farm, not very fertile land, but all the work was done by horse-drawn vehicle, horse-drawn equipment and so forth. So there's something about reaping, there's something about haymaking and various other things like that. And when it moves to Birmingham, Birmingham is really only an example of any city. It could be Dublin, it could be Liverpool, it could be Cork, it could be anywhere, because life was very similar in all those places. And although I was living in a city of over a million people, the part of the city I lived, which was a very working class area, didn't take up more than about a mile across, a square about a mile across. So it was like living in a village where everything was available except the hospital and a few other things like that. If you wanted to go to the greengrocers, as I was often sent by my mother, I had to go about 100 yards or so.
It's beautiful. And people think nostalgia is a thing of the past, but it isn't. And it's again, you've again, very professional production. How long did it take you to write it, and where can people get it?
It was all in all about 2.5 years, yeah. Although I wasn't writing at it all the time. It can be found in Hodges Figures in Dawson Street in Dublin, in Waterstones in Newry and Dundalk, and also in Lisburn. Okay. In Trim, it's at Antonia's Bookshop, Trim County Mead, and other several other shops.
Okay, and look,
but it can be bought online at www.atimeofourlives.com, or people can write to me, Jerry Rice, Trim, County Mead.
Okay, well done, Jerry Rice. Well done. It's called
Thank
The Time
you very
of
much,
Our Lives.
Joe.
How we grew up from the 1940s to the 1960s.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
Okay, a few cookery books. Andrew Rudd. Good afternoon, Andrew.
Good afternoon, Joe. How are you?
This sits with, again, it's a self-published book, but it's a beautiful production. You were a chef. Sell it to us in 140 characters or less.
Well, I tell you what, it's a kind of a one of these projects that I've been looking at doing for maybe 4 or 5 years now, and I was approached a couple of years ago by a publisher, and nothing came of it. And then I had a meeting with a friend of mine who runs a company called Kazoo Self-Publishing, mm-hmm. and she said, well, why don't you look at doing it? So we basically set about it in January of this year. I didn't have any restrictions in terms of, you know, the restrictions that a publisher might give you. So I had pretty good scope in terms of, you know, what I wanted to achieve. Basically, my work and my career is entertaining. I do dinner parties, I cater for people in their homes, and I have a venue in town. So people keep asking me, how can you actually marry flavors, and how can you put menus together where you can match a sort of a canapé with a starter, the main course, and a dessert? And that's what we've actually managed to achieve with this.
And again, it's a lovely production. How much does it cost?
Well, that's the other thing. You don't really make money out of books.
I know.
Honest.
Yeah.
It's a labour of love.
Yeah.
For me, it's something I've wanted to do. I've had a bank of recipes for years, and I've had a lot of friends that have contributed to it. But in a nutshell, between the photography, the food styling, the editing, and the printing, you're talking about the bones of 35,000.
Wow.
Now, you can see that, Joe, in the production value.
Of course you can. It's beautiful.
It's a stunning book. Harry Weir, who's a good pal of mine, he actually did all the photography, and we did all the food styling here in town. So myself and my chef, Paul, did all of that.
And where can people sample your cooking?
Well, I have a private venue in Drury Street in Dublin 4, or Dublin 2. So it's kind of like, you know, we've got 100 odd people in for dinner tonight, actually. It's a kind of a corporate mm-hmm. event. But I do dinner parties in people's homes. I'm doing it actually this afternoon. We've got another dinner party in a house in Balls Bridge, and I've got another one down in Salem's on Saturday. So I do a lot of private catering for people as well.
Okay, and it's £25 online, and it's worth every single penny because, it sits beside any of the lavishly produced cookbooks. But there seems to be a lot more descriptions
you know
and
done,
stories
Joe,
in your...
Yeah. Yeah, I've tried to make the whole thing accessible for people as well, because a lot of cookbooks aren't accessible. You look at a wonderful photograph and you think, how am I going to achieve that? Whereas the kind of the instructions and the descriptions and the ingredients that we use are all very accessible in most supermarkets. I mean, one of my favorites here is the cannelloni, which is very difficult to photograph because it just looks like a mess on the plate. But when I was interrailing, oh God, all those years ago when I left school, I was sitting in a piazza in Verona, and there was a film crew there. This was, what, 1991. Mm-hmm. And I could see in the corner of my eye John Thaw and Kevin Whateley walking past, and they were actually filming an episode of Inspector Morse.
Oh, brilliant.
So for each recipe, I've got a little kind of anecdote and story involved as well.
Well done. It's a fantastic effort for such a young man. Andrew Rudd. Andrew runs Medley in Dublin, and his mouth-watering recipes and inspiring party ideas, and his 25 quid online.
And it's actually available in most bookshops, to be honest, as well.
Oh, great.
It's
got really good distribution. Okay. Well done, Andrew.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
And best of luck. A busy weekend. Olivia Goodwilly. Olivia, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
It's
nice to talk to you.
Spiral Bound. Again, really well produced, handy cookbook, but it focuses on biscuits, breads and cakes. Why?
Because I have been baking. We run a centre here at Lavistown in Kilkenny, and we've been running it for the last 30 years, and I have baked all the biscuits, breads and cakes during that period and have constantly been asked to put the recipes into a book. And finally, finally, I have done this.
And it's a beautiful production.
Well, it's a lovely little production, handy, neat, easy to put on the counter beside you while you're working. I had doubts about the spiral binding, but I am so pleased now that I did it.
Because the spiral binding is ideal for a kitchen.
Especially
everything
for
opens
recipes
flat.
Like for cakes and biscuits, because you need to be quite accurate. Yeah. So you're popping back to the recipe over and over again. And so you need to have it just very easy for you to look at.
Well, as well, it's very, again, very well produced. And how do people get their hands on it? It's obviously Lavistown.
Lavistown, that's Lavistown.
.ie, you have a website,
Website, you will find a button to get you to it, and it will cost you €15 to get it in the post, delivered to your door.
And beautifully. Who did all the paintings?
The paintings are just gorgeous, aren't they? I love the paintings. Little watercolour illustrations by Kate Raggett, who lives in Wales, and I didn't meet her during the process. We just did everything by email, and I met her subsequently, and we got on really well, and we were delighted with the whole project.
Well, she got it bang on. It's called Something in the Tin, biscuits, breads and cakes from 30 years at Lavistown. Olivia Goodwilly, thanks indeed. Another production, it's called Back to Basics, and it's written by the Clare Rose, so to speak, of 2013. That's on the cover. Marie Donnellan. Marie, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe. How are you doing?
Good.
Great to hear from you.
Why a cookbook?
Well, I suppose that's a good question, to be honest. It turned around in about 6 weeks, but why it came about was more so from the charity perspective. So the cookbook is to raise money for the Rape Crisis Centre.
Mm-hmm.
And I was at an event, as you said, as the Clare Rose last year in April, just before I handed back over the sash, on behalf of the Rape Crisis Centre, and they asked me to come and give a talk about the charity on the day. So I did, and I suppose before then I would never really have known a lot about the charity or what they did. Now, after that day, they actually had to close temporarily due to lack of funding in the Midwest. So on the back of that, I decided I was going to do a fundraiser for them. Now, I didn't know at that exact time that it was going to be a cookbook. But it's something I've always loved. I've grown up baking. We had a bed and breakfast, and we used to make scones and apple tarts and basic homemade things every single day. So I just decided it would be a great idea because it's something that they could use as a fundraiser.
And what was the hardest part? What was the unanticipated difficulties? I mean, it's because it's a lovely production again, and it's these are not photocopies. These are lavish productions. What was the hardest part?
The hardest part was the turnaround, Joe, if I'm being honest, because when I approached the charity to do this, I actually meant sometime down the line. I only approached them about 2 months ago, and they jumped at it. They said, oh my God, could we get this out for Christmas? And I said, what? And then I said, okay, look, why not? Let's get it out for Christmas. So the hardest part is, as you can see, obviously a huge amount of time went into it. There's 150 pages in it. It's colour. Everything had to be made and photographed, and myself and stuff, which I'm really happy with. But it was probably the time of putting everything together. We didn't actually have too many baking disasters. I thought there'd be a few more.
Well, it's a very noble effort, and it's a great product as well. It's called Back to Basics, Traditional Baking Book by Mary Donnellan, and it's in aid of the Rape Crisis Network of Ireland. Well done. Well done, Mary Donnellan.
Thank you very much.
Richard Heaney there. Richard, good afternoon.
Yeah, hi. Hello there, Joe.
How are you?
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, but the book in front of me is written by Mickey Finn. It says, words... still running.
Mm-hmm, that's right. I done it under an assumed name, Joe, because nobody ever knew I was in Letterfrack.
Okay.
The wife, the kids or whatever. So I kind of had to, you know, give it to them easy, as they say.
How did you end up in Letterfrack? The industrial school, for people who don't remember. The industrial school.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Connemara. Basically broke into the Town and Country Club. And that set it all off.
Where was that?
In Parnell Square there. So at the back of the Ambassador, the back of the Rotunda.
And what age were you?
I was around 11.
And what, was there a gang of you acting the maggot?
There was four of us.
And what did you rob?
Lemonade.
Oh, for God's sake. And that's how you ended up in Letterfrack?
That's it. We were just fodder.
And
where
were you from in Dublin?
I was in North Great George Street.
Around the corner from Parnell Square.
Yeah, in the tenement
busiest,
there.
The busiest, liveliest street at that time. And now you go from there, from the centre of the busy, teeming capital to the middle of nowhere, Letterfrack.
To the middle of nowhere, yeah.
What was the hardest part?
I don't know. The hardest part was the abuse and the constant beatings and the hunger and the isolation, really, and no contact. Parents couldn't get to the likes of their, in them days, they'd no cars, no phones, no contact, no nothing. Absolutely terrible.
And why did you never tell your family?
I was so embarrassed, so upset and so ashamed, I suppose. I hid it from everyone.
But surely you were traumatised as well.
Oh, definitely. I still am, I'd say.
And did the book help? Does the book help?
The book, Sit Down and Do the Book, is what I wanted to do for years and years. And then when I did do, it did help a lot. Definitely.
And it's searingly honest. It's called, in my own words, Still Running. I'm baffled. I think you should put your... I know you say Mickey Finn.
Yeah. I've just done a course with the Irish Writers' Centre and advised me to redo it under my own name, which I'm going to do in the new year.
All you do is get a sticker and put it on this one.
Mickey. No, I can do it because I self-published it. I can just do that myself.
It's a great effort. And it's by Richard Heaney. And it's H-E-E-N-E-Y. And... as I say, I think you're searingly honest in it.
Yeah.
What did your family think of it?
Oh, everyone loved it. But my fear was that I would be rejected because of it. I didn't publish under my own name.
Yeah, but Richard, people listening, how would people reject you?
Well, I don't know. The thing was, you were there. There was so much. Yeah. You just hid it. You went through your life hiding it. You were so ashamed because, you know, people say, why did you not tell somebody what happened to you there? Why did nobody say anything? You were too ashamed.
You shouldn't be.
Absolutely ashamed. Yeah. Totally. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. In June 1964, a 12-year-old child was summoned to appear at Dublin Magistrates Court. He was sent to Letterfrack Industrial School, situated in Connemara, one of Ireland's most isolated regions. And then you get in, there's no holds barred. For a child, its remoteness found its equal only in a Siberian gulag. The likelihood of escape less than that from San Francisco's Alcatraz prison. Well, you've done it, and you're going to keep on writing.
Oh, yes, I'm on the second book now and toured as well. Yep, doing two at the moment.
But it's bye-bye Mickey Finn and hello Richard Heaney.
That's it. But if anyone wants it, just Google in my own words, Still Running, and it'll come up as Mickey Finn.
Well done.
And it's on Amazon, it's everywhere.
Great achievement. It's such a pleasure. Also, a fright sometimes to see your own book there, but you've done it.
Mm-hmm.
You should be very, very proud of it and very proud of what you've done. And continued writing and continued success, Richard Heaney. God bless
Thanks
you, Richard. Let me go to Michael Feeney. Michael, good afternoon.
And a very good afternoon to you, Joe.
Tell us about your book. It's a memoir.
My story I wrote, I self-published, a bit like Richard just before me, I self-published earlier this year, and it's a story about my 15 years in care from 1951 until 1966. And I was placed in an orphanage 9 days before my second birthday. My older sister Anne was 7, brothers Martin was 5, and Patrick 3.5. And we were placed in care, Anne in an orphanage in Balhadreen, and my brothers and I to Fair Street in Drogheda.
So the family was split up. There was a
vibe. We were split up, and I did not see my sister again for 12 years. When she came to the industrial school in Salt Hill, where we were sent when we were 10, to actually take my brother Patrick to England when he was 16.
And your father died on Christmas Day in 1981.
He did. He died on Christmas Day in 1981. He burned to death in where he was living in Ashford in County Wicklow. Mum had died, of course, 20-odd years before that anyway, when I was 11. And, of course, I never did see Mum again. She couldn't come to the school, a bit like Richard's story prior. Couldn't come to visit, and she died in June of 1960. And I was going to be going home on holidays to her the following month. But God, in the infinite way that he does things, probably decided I didn't need to see my mother. She was a broken woman by then anyway. Okay. And
but you headed to Australia, as indeed did four of your siblings, who are now living in Australia where you are. You're in New South Wales. How did you get to Australia? You took the slow route.
I took the slow route. My sister, of course, was living in England, working there, had married, and they had won £1,000 in a competition, and in a moment of pure madness, they decided to buy a combi van. I was working in Galway in O'Gorman's as a bookbinder. I visited them in a summer of 72, and they put the proposition to me that they were thinking of driving to Australia, and would I, you know, come along for the ride? I didn't give an instant answer, of course. I decided to think about it for a few weeks, and then I did get back to him. I said,
and it took 9 months.
I've always wanted to go to Australia. We'll give it a go.
Okay, originally from Ballinrobe in County Cork, Michael Feeney's book is called Lost Between Two Shores. It's self-published. The genre is memoir, and we'll put it up on our website. It's 3:15. Loads of books still to get through.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
Let's gallop through some self-published children's book. It's called Angel Alley. Josephine Harhan, tell us about your book, Josephine, aimed at children.
Well, it's a little book about a little girl called Katie, and she wakes up on the morning of her birthday, her 7th birthday, and she sees a bundle of feathers at the bottom of the bed. It turns out it's her guardian angel called Ellie. And this little angel is invisible to everybody else but Katie. And they have lots of adventures and stuff like that going on around all their playing together.
Okay, and it's print Irish. It's published and printed by Lettertech at selfpublishedbooks.ie. Let me bring Orla in. Orla Kelly, your book is called, your children's book, self-published, is called?
Good afternoon, Joe. Yes, it's called the Owly Trilogy, which is a combination of three children's stories.
Owly Saves the Magic Medicine Tree.
Then the next one is Owly and the Enchanted Forest, and Spirit of the Forest helps Owly and friends.
And why did you write it?
Initially, I wrote them for my two kids, Emer, who's nearly 7, and Michael, who's nearly 10. But I found that the positive life messages and life skills they contain should actually be available for all children. Because what these books do is, through story and through the power of imagination, they teach children about overcoming challenges, looking out for each other, helping themselves, appreciating the environment and making the world a better place. And I suppose as a mum, we all want to nurture our kids, but at the same time, we need to equip them with the life skills that will help develop them personally.
And they're lovely stories, and they're all happy ever after too, aren't they?
I think that's very important, because that really captures the whole essence of what childhood should be about.
Yeah, here, and given the stories we've just heard, the two memoirs. Orla Kelly is called the Owly Trilogy, if you're looking for it, and again, all details up in a few minutes. Tom Laramie. Tom, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, how are you?
You give out the title of this book.
It's Ring Ping Ding and Ling and the Watering Hole.
Okay. Tell us quickly what it's about.
Four camels and the animals at the Fairhaven Animal Rescue Park. It's an effective bedtime story. Animals like belly laugh giraffe, never tell gazelle, can do kangaroo, bottomless hippopotamus, stuff like, animals like that. The rhyme and repetition is really good for helping kids get relaxed and fall asleep. And belly laugh giraffe has a motto, which is every day LABK. Every day, laugh and be kind.
It's a soup.
Now I also do.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Keep going.
No, I also do a personalized CD of me reading the story and mentioning the child's name in the beginning and at the end of the story. So that's been helpful for sales.
Beautifully illustrated. The animal, the color paintings are superb. They really are.
Terry Kelleher from Galway. I can't say enough about her. She is just wonderful.
Okay, it's called Ring, Ping, Ding and Ling and the Watering Hole. Tom Laramie. Good morning, good Tom. This next one is called What If? Is Sarah Murphy there?
Yes, Joe. Hi, how are you?
Again, for young children.
It's for 48-year-olds. It's a picture book and it offers little gems of wisdom to children to help them in everyday situations. So, one side of the page would say, what if your ball rolls out from the road?
That's the page I have open, yeah.
All right, okay. And the other side would say, don't run after it. You can get another ball, but you can't get another
because you're leaving a little bit out. You say, what if your football rolled across the road? And one little child is saying to us, they're saying to each other, oh no, that's my new ball. And you can see they're ready to run. But you make the point, do not run after it. You can buy another ball, but you can't buy another you. You are special. Beautiful. A great way of telling that story.
Yeah, so I'm sort of trying to use humour to encourage them to think about things. And also the illustrations are designed to encourage their own creativity. I read the book to five-year-olds in the library recently, and one of the five-year-olds, when I had asked the group to make up their own what-ifs and using their own artwork later on, one of the five-year-olds said to me, I can't draw a car, and he was nearly in tears. And I showed him my car, and then he sort of straightened himself up and thought, well, I can do a better job than that. Well, here I go.
A lovely production. Print Irish, self-published books.ie, and that was Sarah Murphy. Mario Corrigan. Mario, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. How are you?
Off you go. Tell us about your productions, because there's three of them.
We have The Battle for Coleman's Wood, which is Roscommon. We have The Writer's Revenge, which is Listowel, and Do Fish Wear Pyjamas, which is based in Kildare Town.
Age group you're aimed at. What are they similar to?
8+. I mean, the idea behind it is, who needs Hogwarts? I mean, we don't have to go and create a magical, wonderful world. We have it on our doorstep in the traditions, in the stories, in the landscape of all around us. And you're trying to introduce the kids to that, but you're trying to give them the wonderful adventure stories that they're used to.
And what do you do in real life, Mario?
I'm a librarian with Kildare Library and Arts Services.
Fantastic. They're beautiful productions.
Great, thanks a million. Yeah. I'm very lucky. We have a great illustrator, and I mean, it's trying to give them it in a modern concept, but it's involving the kids. If you look at the back of the books, all the names of the children who are involved are included. Basically, you walk into a classroom and you say, well, I'm going to write a book, we're going to write a book, and they all go, yeah, and then you just give them a title, or if you have a title, take out the vocabulary and use their ideas to actually craft a book.
Okay, I should remember. Well done, Mario.
Brilliant, thank you very much.
They look great, and congratulations on your work, and the libraries do a great job. By the way, Josephine Harhan's Angel Alley with the Feather, that's been launched in Moat tonight at 6 p.m. Kevin Sheridan, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. How are you?
What do you do in real life, Kevin?
I'm a personal trainer and I'm a teacher.
What's your book?
I work out in Ballymun Youth Reach.
Oh, great. What's your book about?
The book is called Catching a Falling Star, Joe.
Okay.
And basically it's set actually over in Boston. And it's about, the start to the book is kind of about a tramp down and out, had a terrible thing that happened to his life. And he's just in a very dark place. And I started writing this, Joe, at the time when the recession was just really bad, when so many people were really hurting. And I wanted to write a book that's uplifting in that, something that's motivating, something that's able to show people how to go about finding their true calling in life. And I suppose much more importantly, Joe, to finding the courage to do it. That's kind of what the book was primarily about. And after I wrote it, the first thing I did was I sent it over to, have you heard of Brian Tracy, the motivational guru in America?
Go ahead.
Yeah, basically he's one of the top motivational speakers in the world, and he's a best-selling author. And I sent it over to him to ask him to read it and to get a testimonial. And when I got a testimonial, a lovely one from him, then I was really able to put the whole thing together and that. And that's when it really just kind of
and
took off.
Could you describe it as a self-help book, Kevin?
No, not primarily, Joe. Not a self-help. This is a novel. But basically, it's about, you know, finding your
truth. Oh, sorry. I take your point. Yeah, and I'm now flicking through it. It was
just about finding your true purpose in life. And it's also a love story as well. Now, it's not a 50 Shades of Grey story.
Okay, thank God. It's a story of love, loss and reconciliations and of finding courage and about, to follow one's dreams.
And there's also, you know, kind of a very strong spiritual dimension to it as well. Because when so many people were bruised and battered, I wanted to write something that would really kind of uplift them on that. And hopefully that's what it is, Joe.
Okay, that's Kevin Sheridan. It's a novel. It's called Catching a Falling Star. Details are going up. Teresa Rafferty. Teresa, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
What's your book called? What's your book called?
It's called The Web and the Wing. In other words, the wing is, you know, perhaps the ability to transcend to a certain extent problems we not really important, and the web is how the world, you know, all the different attractions in the world.
It's set in the aftermath of the 1914 war.
It starts there on Armistice Day, and it takes the reader, it's a trilogy, and it takes the reader through. It includes Spain and Germany. And of course, England, which is where it's really based. And it's the characters cover a vast range of from extreme wealth to poverty in all three countries. But what I'm really writing is because I'm old enough to have I lived through the Second World War. I was about almost seven when the Blitzing started in Manchester. We lived only a few miles from Manchester. And I remember it all vividly.
It's such a
I always had the intention to write this book because what I'm really aiming to do is thought provoke. Because we've got to find a better, humanity has to find a better way of dealing with war.
Okay.
I don't want to go on too much. I'd like you to ask me things.
No, it's called The Web and the Wing. It's by Teresa Rafferty. It's, again, a lovely production. Well done. It's Matador are the self-publishing company and it's in the category of fiction. And as I say, the cover will jump at you anyway. Well done, Teresa. 51551. Back after this.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815. Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
Lynn Loftus' self-published book is called Auntie Dolly's Letters. What provoked you and inspired you, Lynn?
Hi, Joe. Thanks for having me on. Well, we found Auntie Dolly's letters, my Auntie Dolly's letters, in a an old suitcase after she'd passed away in Toronto. We found them in 2001. And they were 16 years of love letters written by a gentleman who was living in Saskatchewan, Canada. She was then living in Liverpool. And he wrote to her for all 16 years. But we also found letters from two other gentlemen in the suitcase as well. And so it became quite an intriguing story. And it showed a side of Auntie Dolly that we hadn't known. and also Jack, who wrote the letters, wrote a terrific commentary on life in the Great Depression.
I see that.
And
it's a social history as well. It's the day, it's in the day when letter writing was so crafted and elegant and informative and not short little scribbles, long detailed stories almost. It's called Auntie Dolly's Letters, beautifully produced again by Lynn Rees Loftus. Where do you base yourself, Lynn?
I'm in Greystones. I'm a writer and illustrator, mostly of children's educational books.
And that's one of the reasons, I think, why the book is so looks so beautiful. It really does. Auntie Dolly's Letters. Let us go to Liam Nolan. Liam, good afternoon.
Afternoon, Joe. Compliments of the season to you.
Yeah, and you, Liam, and many more than people recognise your beautiful, beautiful voice, because this is Liam Nolan. I thought you did sit in this building for a number of years, but you were also in the GPO when you presented a morning programme. Isn't that right, Liam?
And people... Yeah, that's a long time ago, Joe. I'll never forget getting out of the lift one day and a man came up to me and he said, excuse me, he said, was your father's name Eddie Nolan? Was he from the Liberties? And I said, yes, he was. I want to thank you, he said. And I said, for what? He said, because he taught me how to read and how to be literate, and I'm secretary of the Musicians Union. And I think his name was Paddy Malone.
Oh, God. And Liam, you are writing, you're still active down in Loughrea. Razzle Dazzle 2014, tell us about it.
It's the 10th edition, Joe. It started off as something, 10 years ago, as a very, very slim little book. And what had happened was I was teaching a class, creative writing, and at the end of 2 years, I just threw out the idea to them, would they be interested in trying to get an anthology out? And if the answer was yes, that it would mean a lot of hard work, a lot of rejection, a lot of discipline, a lot of all kinds of things, they said yes. And here we are with the 10th edition now and over 300 stories published already.
And it's another great production. I've had a look at your story, obviously. A great opening, as per usual. You know how to catch the reader. And there are many creative writing groups around the country. If there are, friends, contact them on their website and see what they have for a Christmas gift, because these are short stories and think pieces, and they are very evocative and indeed very, very good as well. You're hale and hearty, Liam.
Say that again, Joe.
You are hale and hearty. Well,
Having difficulty hearing you.
Okay, you're in.
One of the legacies of broadcasting, Joe, was an encroaching deafness.
Oh, God, I didn't know that.
So I wear hearing aids, and every now and again, what they do is that they magnify the sound in a way that your own ears do not do. Your own ears are selective, and these things are pieces of equipment.
Okay.
And like a lot of equipment, they can distort.
Okay. Well, you never... That's one thing people remarked on your broadcasting career, Liam Nolan. The one voice that never distorted was that. It was your own beautiful, beautiful voice. Thanks indeed, Liam Nolan. That's the way to finish, even though I only think I got through half of all the brilliant effort that people sent us in. All of them are going up on our website, and tweet and retweet and tell your friends those books are out there. And congratulations to every single person who was involved in producing those books. They are magnificent, magnificent achievements. Nessa Carter was the researcher, Laurie Davis is the BCO, Pat O'Carney on sound, Siobhan Hawk the series producer, Tim Desmond is the producer. Spirit Level on Sunday at 5 for a very special Christmas edition, including Finding That Child, the voice we put out in Liveline 2 weeks ago, 6 years of age, 40 years ago. We found the child. You can meet him on Monday in the Christmas special. And Derek Mooney is next.